The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
You're alive, I think. You're sitting there anyhow. You are alive. You're a moving, living, breathing creature. You are composed of matter, and so am I. Even air itself, anything that occupies space, that has weight, that has, as we say, mass, even though maybe it's shapeless like water, unless it forms in the shape of the vessel in which it's contained, is matter. But what is the matter? Where did matter come from? How did it get here? This question of origins and whether or not you can prove there is a God, as opposed to proving evolution, is a very fascinating subject when you really get into it. The two are opposing religions, really. The theologians, on the one hand, say they accept the belief in an all-wise divine creator being, and then all the variable interpretations of what that creator being says in his word come along later, but at least they accept it on the basis of faith. And somehow, somewhere along the line, faith became something that is based upon nothing, a direct contradiction of what the Bible calls it. And on the other hand, evolutionists say they believe in the evolutionary dogma, the assertion that life came into existence from the not living, that chance with a capital C created order and beauty and harmony, that randomness created intricate interdependability. And how did this happen? Explosions in print shops all of a sudden create encyclopedias, do they? Airplane crashes create brand new aerodynamic models that become new jetliners? It doesn't make sense, but that's what they believe. So I've been showing in a series of programs that there are seven proofs that God does exist. Theologians who tell you there's no need to prove it, you must accept it on faith, apparently have not read either the biblical definition of faith or the challenges in the Bible that say, prove all things, hold fast that which is good, or that say, that which may be known of God is evident to them, for he has shown it to them, because from the creation, by looking at that which exists, in other words, matter, the invisible things are understood. The invisible things of God's Godhead and His divinity are understood by looking at the things that have been made. You know, it's interesting. On one hand, evolutionary science seems to say that you have to line everything up in sequence from simple blobs and life forms like amoebas and single-celled animals on up to birds and fish and man. So you see the fin of a fish and the wing of a bird and the hand of a man, or even the form of the veins in the underneath part of a lily pad or the leaf of a tree, and they say that one came from another. And instead of seeing similarity in pattern, instead of seeing similarity in design, instead of admitting the simple analogy that many art critics who study the brush tactics and the pattern and the touch or the finesse or whatever it is they call it, the brush strokes and the methods of creating a master painting, they say, oh, this was done by so-and-so. Why? How can they say that? Well, they recognize the pattern. They recognize his technique. Architects' buildings are identified the same way. You don't say the big building came from the little one and it came from the little one out back. The one grew from the other? Ridiculous. Well, of course, we're talking about presumably inanimate architecture. But on the other hand, why not take some of the arguments of evolution and given the idea that there may be an alternative to the evolutionary suggestion that there is no God, use some of these same evolutionary arguments as actual arguments for a creator? Because intricacy of design is another separate argument all by itself. But I have been showing that there are seven major proofs that God does exist. And they are in this order, as I have been giving them to you. First, that law, incontrovertible, immutable law that acts upon us and doesn't ask our permission, and Newton doesn't own gravity, and science doesn't take law and then define it, put a name to it, and suddenly possess it, manipulate it to its own will. Science can only try to define how some of these laws act, as to why they act that way. And when they got started, science confesses it doesn't know. But law, to any rational mind, requires a lawgiver. Life, I have proved on this series of programs, life itself, all about us, life exists because of pre-existing life and pre-existing life of the same kind. And life is interdependent. It's complex. It is supported by other life systems. And it is only through the decomposition of
former living organisms by bacteria. The creation of mineral salts is in the case of the water, which then rise to the surface and are eaten then by phytoplankton or zooplankton, which completes a complete cycle. And then the small fish feeding on that, the larger on them, and man on the larger ones, and so on. It's all part of a kind of a complex machine that is like a giant piece of machinery that had somebody push a button and got it started this way. And it's gradually running down. It's gradually disintegrating. Now that brings us to the third major proof. The first is, remember, law demands a lawgiver. The second is that life demands a life giver. And the third is, there is a creation. Matter exists. You're composed of it, and so am I. All material things. Things exist. They had to come into existence from somewhere. Now, there are two ways to approach it. Take it apart, or try to put it together. Now, presently, science is trying to do the latter. That is, they're dealing with some of the primordial soup, they claim, like methane, ammonia, amino acids, the sugars, and so on, carbon. They're trying to tell you, in short, that life, and they're not sure what it is, and neither apparently is the Supreme Court, because they're not quite sure when it stops. And some people on the abortion thing are not even sure when it begins. But that life is composed of the same stuff of which not living matter is composed. You, in short, and I are all composed of the same stuff that is under our feet when we walk out here in the fields and the rocks. Matter is pretty uniform. When you take it apart, you're going one direction. You get down to the smallest particles and to find out what matter is. People don't really know yet. Science doesn't really know yet. They used to think many years ago that the smallest divisible particle of matter was the molecule. Now, to give you some idea, if they even know just what a molecule is for sure, and of course you can see them under microscopes, it would take you, how many, be several million times a second for several million years to count the molecules in one drop of water. Well, then they discovered that there are smaller particles, and they call these atoms. And that atoms, then, even have smaller parts, and that atoms are made up of a nucleus and neutrons, protons, electrons, and so on, and that they are in constant motion. And like a tiny little universe all by themselves, with these electrons spurting about in rapid motion around the nucleus, they're like a tiny universe in a little microcosm in an atom. Along came the discovery, beginning back in 1922 originally, when man began to discover the idea of fission or fissionable material, of actually exploding an atom and causing atoms to burst asunder. Fissionable material had to be discovered to create the match that would ignite fusionable material. That's what's taking place inside the sun every moment. Every 1 second, the sun up there, a giant solar furnace giving off tremendous heat, light, energy, sometimes even deadly waves and rays, is using up more energy in each second than all of mankind has from his earliest origins, with all of his trucks and his bulldozers and graders and lifters, machinery, ships, aircraft, men, horses, automobiles. Every second, more energy is given off by the sun than humankind has used in our human history. Well, they came up with the ability then not only to take apart, but to blend by fusion atoms, and this became the hydrogen bomb. They couldn't do it with just simple hydrogen, the hydrogen atom, because it's too light. So they came along with deuterium and with tritium, which are merely words that mean second and third. In other words, the second heaviest hydrogen atom and the third heaviest or the most heavy hydrogen atom. And these were obtained through heavy water and by heat. And then finally they learned that they could use an atom bomb, fissionable material, to create the heat required before they could fuse the hydrogen atoms into a helium atom and other atoms, and these new complex atoms, in the process of fusing one and making it become different types of atoms, gave off tremendous heat and energy, hence a hydrogen bomb. But a hydrogen bomb is merely man's ability, finally, to unlock a little bit of the energy that was compacted inside matter when matter was created, when it came into existence. And in this, the basic building block of matter, the hydrogen atom, lies one of the most important proofs that God does exist, because a creation had to have a creator. And the disintegration of hydrogen through the process of fusion, like in the stars and the sun in a hydrogen bomb, the giving off of heat, light, and energy, and changing it into the helium atom, is in itself a major proof that God exists. Evolutionary scientists always have a beginning point, and that beginning point is with the existence of matter. They begin with an orderly universe already in a cooling process, an Earth that presumably split off when a giant sun exploded, the sun, the planets, and the moon, of course, and the moons of the other planets, and then with recent discoveries as a result of lunar walks by humankind and lunar rocks, which have been brought back, and I have had the privilege of seeing under a microscope some of those tiny particles as well as larger rocks at various expositions and conventions and the like where they've been on display. So they always begin with matter in existence. Now the way this is subtly put into your child's mind in school is kind of interesting. It's, if you found, for example, maybe you're the member of, let's say, the Catholic faith, and you sent your child, because there wasn't a Catholic school or a parochial school in your neighborhood, maybe you sent your child to a regular, you know, a state-supported or community-supported school, which was of no particular religious bent one way or the other. But you discovered that this particular school board had allowed all sorts of books to be used as texts in its classes, even mathematics, perish the thought, which had subtle influences and inferences that the Catholic Church was wrong and that this other church was better, that it was right, and they were undermining what you as a family wanted your child to believe. You'd be a little upset, wouldn't you, when you discovered this? You know, there are millions of Americans who believe in God, including the president. Past presidents have had Bibles on their desk in the Oval Office at the White House. Presidents such as some of our founding fathers, among them Abraham Lincoln and others, have made appeals for the nation to return to its God. Well, in this all this business about separation of church and state and the suits that have gone all the way to the Supreme Court about getting rid of prayers and all this in schools, we have left another religion very thoroughly entrenched in our school books that no one has sought out. And that's the religion of godless atheism or the denial of the existence of a God. That's the religion, the dogmatic assertion of a faith that matter came into existence from nothing without any cause, a faith in randomness, chance, circumstance, and accident, that this created order, beauty, and harmony, a faith that we all came from amoeba or from green slime or from polka-dotted air bubbles in the sea. Here's the way it's gotten across to your child. We live under the shadow of a gigantic question mark, says this book, a textbook, at younger children aimed at educating them, on the story of mankind by Henrik van Loon. Who are we? Where do we come from? And whither are we bound? A little later on he said, in the beginning, the planet upon which we live was, as far as we now know, a large ball of flaming matter. In the beginning it was flaming matter. What makes matter flame? What is a flame? What is fire? What is matter? Where does matter come from? How do we begin with a universe that already does follow the immutable law that bodies alone, left by themselves, if they are heated, will gradually tend to cool instead of do the reverse. But here it is. Gradually, in the course of millions of years, the surface burned itself out and was covered with a thin layer of rocks. So here's matter. Then, one day, the great wonder happened, says the textbook. What had been dead gave birth to life. Now, nobody believes that in medical science today. And the doctor comes out and says, I almost saved him. It's not good news to the family. Nobody really believes it, but here it is in a textbook, and your child absorbs it. Now, maybe you've been teaching your child that God exists. Remember, J. Edgar Hoover said, any child who is taught to obey the laws of God will have precious little difficulty in obeying the laws of man. Maybe you are, as a lot of people would say, a church-going, God-fearing family. And in the meantime, the school system has all sorts of books in there that are inserting into your child's mind all kinds of questions. They're telling your child, no, men really did drag their knuckles. They could follow each other's knuckle drags. You know, you're going out and wondering, where is everybody? Oh, there's a fresh knuckle drag. Henry just went by. Hair all over him. Henry the Neanderthal. Well, a fall merely means valley. Yeah, it does in German. And Neander, you know, that was a valley in Germany, so it's a German valley man. And we have to use these strange names about where places were discovered or people were found or the fossil, or maybe the man who discovered the fossil, as the case may be. But, you know, these things are inserted into our kids' minds. They actually think that men used to live in caves and drag women around by the hair and club them. It's in the comic books practically every Sunday. the comic section of the newspaper, there's always something. I mean, Alley Oop is still a going comic strip. They're replete with a time machine, of course, today. But they always begin with matter. In the beginning, they say it was a hydrogen atom, but don't ask us where that came from. Let me give you that quote. Scientists believe the basic building block of the material universe is the hydrogen atom, according to Harvard University astronomer Harlow Shapley. And he said, and I quote, "Science has found the basic hydrogen atom, but who made the hydrogen atom? Science comes up against some things which are unanswerable as yet." Another one said, this is an article by a science writer in a leading West Coast newspaper, "There are several theories, but only theories, as to how the universe began. One theory is that of the Big Bang. The universe grew out of this blast of a single giant atom." Now, that's got to be a big atom. Let me tell you how big that atom has got to be. I want to show you something real quickly about whether or not we could travel at the speed of light, which we can't. But if we could, in an effort to comprehend the size, the breadth of our own galaxy, here's a little bit of an explanation of just how big an atom that would have had to have been. The galaxy we live in is composed of approximately, and they arrive at this in about the same way you would if you were trying to figure the population of the world and you happened to focus in on a square mile of New York City, and you figured how many people lived in all those high-rise tenement buildings, then you divided up the Earth in square miles and multiplied by the number and came up with a population. I mean, they take a postage stamp size of the sky, multiply the number of stars they can count, because they can't count them all. Let's face it. You know, they're going to lose, you know, that many fingers and toes. They're going to lose track. The galaxy we live in is composed of approximately 200 billion stars, approximately, give or take a few hundred million. However, our galaxy, or unit of stars, is only one of billions, that's estimated, of course, of galaxies. Each of these galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars. Now, each star, remember, is larger, generally speaking, than our own sun, which is looked upon as an orange dwarf. And each one of these is so brilliant and is giving off so much light that there may be any number of planets that dwell in its shadow, giving off only a dull reflection, but are paled into insignificance by the brilliance of the star itself. Who knows how many billions of planets there may be in other universes virtually like ours, or galaxies, in other words. Now, light travels, so they thought. Now they're beginning to speculate that maybe it doesn't after all. But you would have been called a little bit less than intelligent to wonder about that a few years ago. At 186,000 miles per second, not exactly, but that's a round figure. So, it can circle the Earth 7 times per second. A light year is an incomprehensible distance then for a person or a spaceship or light itself to travel, which is 6 trillion miles in a year. 6 trillion? That's a fairly good trip. Now, if you could build a spaceship that traveled at the speed of light, it would take 8 minutes traveling at that speed to reach the sun. That's an ordinary yellow dwarf. In half an hour, you would get out to Jupiter. In 1 hour, you would be at Saturn. And in 5 hours, you would be past Pluto to the outermost planet of our own solar system. And then you're off on your way to the stars. Now, you know how long it takes. You know, you're waiting years sometimes to hear about men's space shots that are going to bypass Mars and so on. But here, if you're traveling now at the speed of light instead of the speed of man's most recent technology. So at 186,000 miles per second, your next closest star, Alpha Centauri, would still be 4 1/3 light years away. That's times 6 trillion, remember. That's about 25 trillion miles from the Earth. And to get to Sirius, the brightest of our neighbors, would take 8 1/2 light years. Another, Aldebaran, would take 55 light years. And still another, which is called Regal, is 543 years away, traveling at the speed of light. And all this time, you haven't left what astronomers call our own neighborhood. You haven't gotten out of one little corner of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. In all these hundreds and hundreds, 543 light years in all, and you've gotten past about 3 stars. Well, if the universe was one giant atom, you've got to admit that at some time or another, there sure was a big chunk of matter out there, wherever there is supposed to be. In a moment, I'll come back and give you a strange admission, a fact about the undeniable proof that the basic building block of hydrogen could not have always been in existence by the very operation of the sun itself.
There's a new Europe coming. From the days when Europe was reduced to rubble at the end of World War II, the plain truth has been predicting its rebirth as a world power. As this European bloc develops independently of the United States and Russia, the plain truth keeps you informed with advanced articles. And now, as the European common market emerges economically and politically to shape the world, the plain truth brings you the dramatic story behind Europe's return to power, with articles like Europe, Supergiant of the 70s, and There's a New Europe Coming. The plain truth helps you keep ahead of events in this fast-moving world at a price we can all afford. It's free. The plain truth, after 39 years, still ahead of its time. Send your request to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales.
Now remember, one of the most important theories about the origin of matter was the idea of one giant atom that one day exploded. And as I said, that hydrogen atom was pretty respectable in size. Here's the quotation from that article that I mentioned earlier about the blast of a single giant atom. Of course, just where this mammoth atom came from is a mystery as great as the creation of the universe. And here follows the admission, quote, "It is as tremendous a thing for a single atom to be created from nothing as the whole of the universe." Well, of course it is that the universe came from a single atom. We're still beginning with a fantastic encyclopedia. We don't believe man drills get a typewriter to create the article for the Declaration of Independence of the United States of America. We do not believe can with a capital T create order, beauty, harmony, and life. And science admits it doesn't even know what life means yet. Several years ago, Dr. Jeffrey L. Greenstein, who was then an astrophysicist at Caltech, said in regard to the perplexing origin of the universe, and I quote, "It is a terrible mystery how matter comes out of nothing. Could it have been something outside of science? We try to stay out of philosophy and geology, but sometimes we are forced to think in bigger terms to go back to something outside of science." Well, matter exists, and matter is only energy in solid form. Matter is composed of molecules. The molecular structure of matter, matter is then composed of trillions upon trillions of atoms, and those atoms in themselves are like tiny universes in constant motion. They are energy. The hydrogen bomb, the fusion, the process of blending atoms into yet other atoms, such as the hydrogen to the helium process, and giving off the heat, the light, the energy, and this vast explosion, in itself proves that there was no past eternity of matter, and that matter itself had to have a beginning. It's interesting when you go back to ask, well, when did this start and when did the other thing start? They all say, oh, a few billions of years ago. But sooner or later, when you take all the speculations and put them together, you see that science is almost unanimous in saying that the origins of the universe are only a few billion years in the past. They want to say 4.5 billion, that's fine with the Bible. If they want to say 10 billion, that's fine with the Bible. The Bible doesn't say the universe is only 6,000 years old. It says in the beginning everything was created perfectly, and then there came a giant holocaust. There came giant explosions. There came a battle in the universe for the supremacy. And the word was, became, in the first verse of the first chapter of the book of Genesis, allows for a completely indeterminate past, eternity, or creation of whatever span of time you wish. There's no contradiction whatsoever. In the biblical statement in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth became, if you read the Hebrew correctly, look it up in an exhaustive time course, without form and void. Science says in the beginning was a hydrogen atom. Theology says, the Bible says, in the beginning, God created. You've got to accept something from nothing if you accept evolution, and you've got to believe in a lot more miracles and far more improbable and giant leaps that are completely inexplicable to accept evolution than to accept the biblical doctrine of creation. Well, here's the proof. This is an undeniable fact. The physicists and astronomers tell us that hydrogen, the simplest element, is the basic building block from which all the elements are ultimately derived. They tell us that multiple billions of tons of hydrogen are being consumed and transformed by the stars every second. But if hydrogen had always existed, it should long ago have all been used up. It shows there is no past eternity of matter, and that our Earth and our solar system, our galaxy, is like a giant solar furnace surrounded by living, pulsating suns. And it's like a giant clock that one day was wound up, and ever since has been gradually running down. The very process of erosion, of water seeking its own level, of mountains gradually lowering and the seas and lakes gradually filling, should tell us that the world is running down. Now, aside from the fact the world is running out of space, and the world is running out of drinkable water and breathable air, it is also running down even through the timeless, ageless process of erosion. The world had a beginning, and matter had a beginning. The creation exists. It could not have existed without a creator. That is proof number three. No new energy is being produced in the form of the burying of fossil plants to produce coal. No new natural gas is being created. No new deposits of crude oils are being put in this earth. Every time man pumps out 1 gallon, there is 1 gallon left. Every time he burns a ton of coal and changes it from coal into heat and light and energy to do useful work, there is 1 ton of coal left. Creation is running downhill. There has been no past eternity of matter. Matter had a beginning. It also, therefore, has a discernible end. Sure, it seems to take ages.
It operates, but it's running gradually downhill, and it absolutely demonstrates there was no past eternity of matter, that matter had at one time to come into existence and did not always exist. What's embarrassing about believing in a supreme creator God? Well, there are 7 proofs God exists. Now, this booklet, Does God Exist?, that we'll send you by return mail free of charge, gives you every one of these proofs that I've been mentioning on a series of programs, going through every single one of these 7 proofs God exists. You write for this booklet if you want some real solid proofs for further research and discussion on your own part. All 7 of them, one after another, very tangible, easy to read, simple to understand. You need to write for the booklet, Does God Exist? And it's free of charge. There is no price whatsoever. Now, all you need to do to receive this booklet is to give us the call letters of your station. We'd like that, if you would please, the call letters of your radio station. And while you're at it, why don't you request the current number of the Plain Truth and find that there is a solution beyond human understanding. And we talk in the Plain Truth plainly, even about Bible prophecy and about an ultimate solution beyond the acknowledgement of today's news media, because they simply do not acknowledge God or Bible prophecy. And that's what you will read in the Plain Truth. It is Plain Truth, straight from the shoulder, plain talk. I hope you'll write for it. We'll send it to you by return mail as soon as you dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.